Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room is Mary Scott Boria. She will be speaking on the multicultural future. So let's listen in on Mary Scott Boria.
I decided today that what I would like to do is to be less formal, to be more casual, and to be more discussion-y. I am not an expert in any of these topics. I think what brought me here is probably my interest and my affiliation with people and some work, but I don't at all find myself to be having expertise in multiculturalism or racism or any of those other topics. But I think about them a lot and I study about them a lot, and I hope to have some knowledge, but I realize that there's an accumulation of knowledge that we all have, and so I don't want to set myself up as the expert. What I would like for us to do is maybe we can start and say who we are, why you're here, what sort of brought you here. I realized in speaking to someone yesterday that the labels that we put up there might be a little bit misleading, so I would like to have an opportunity to hear a little bit about what piqued your interest, and hopefully that we'll be able to sort of build on that. So, well, welcome everyone. I'm not sure if I'm going to have any new information to give, primarily because I'd like for us to dialogue, and I think that it's important to talk about this topic because I don't think that we are in places in our lives where we talk about it very much. And that may be an assumption that I'm making, but I think if we live pretty much in a monocultural sort of setting, there are not a lot of opportunities to talk about multicultural, multiracial. And we're not very comfortable when we are in those settings. We don't know if we're saying the right things or feeling the right things, and we don't want to get accused of bad intentions, and so we don't always have the opportunity to have good dialogue about multiracial, multicultural experiences. And so I think even beyond the learning, the opportunity to just dialogue is a good way to practice, I think, having those discussions. I feel like I have them all the time, and I feel like I don't have them enough. And I do this pretty much all the time in my life, even when I'm not working. This is sort of an experience that I live. I live in a multicultural family. It's very multicultural. I'm of a mixed race background, and I have a Puerto Rican husband, and I have a Mexican son-in-law. And my daughter is probably destined to marry someone who's Asian to sort of fill it out. I'm sure my grandmother has some Native American, and my mother is of German background. So it's pretty multicultural, though my experience has been African American. I've lived an African American life. And probably it's only been since I've been married that I've been even challenged by a day-to-day existence that's multicultural, because my mother pretty much in her day and time was isolated from the white community and pretty much had to live her life in the African-American community. So that background we didn't have any exposure to. We didn't have any experience with her background. So that's pretty much who I am. I'd like for us to take a minute before I sort of say a little bit about what my own biases are in terms of doing this particular workshop. I would like for us to just take a minute to just sit for a second and think about in your own life the places where there are multicultural, multiracial experiences. And let me just say that my bias is really more towards race and racism. And I want to say that up front because I don't want to give wrong impressions about discussing issues that I have not had a lot of experience with that are much more broader multicultural issues. That doesn't mean that I don't see the importance of embracing culture in a very broad way, but my own background and my own experience has really been centered around the issue of race. and racism. And so I kind of want to lay that out there. And my bias and my perspective will be more towards looking at the question of race. I've had lots of experience on women's issues and have been able to draw those issues into my own understanding and issues around class, gender, sexual orientation are all issues that I think are very critical to a broad discussion around multiculturalism. But I want to focus a little bit more on race because that's where I feel most able to draw my own experiences. But I want you to take a minute and I want you to just relax. This is a relaxing place. So all we do here is eat and relax. And just take a moment to think about those places in your life where there are multiracial experiences. And I want you to draw on in your own meditation of that. What are some of the values that you embrace in those experiences? And what are some of the struggles that happen in those experiences? And we'll just, what I'd like for us to do is just to take a moment to do that and then maybe share a few moments of some stories. So, say about a minute.
Is that current?
Currently, yeah. Past, if you'd like, that'd be fine too.
Currently, it's hard.
Past. Anybody like to share something?
Minnesota has legalized gambling. We have a lot of casinos. And I'm sure there must be some other states too, but the Indians, the Native Americans have the rights to the gambling, to the money. And a lot of people in Minnesota, how many, are saying that, you know, this should be more broadly based and it should be put out into the rest of the population. So there's a real racism, I think, brewing there because the Indians, Native Americans, are making a lot of money, millions of dollars of profit. And you know, I'm thinking, hey, right on, that's okay. And then I think, well, gee, then maybe we better, you know, because now they're doing so well, that maybe we could spread it out a bit and provide more money for schools or developing more industries as some of the monies, the tax monies, go for. So that's a real brewing issue in our state right now.
It's interesting. I'd never thought about gambling as something that would be embraced.
I think maybe the issue is not the topic of gambling, but what happens when you give a racial class a special privilege that no one else gets? Mm-hmm. What happens with the jealousy? And if you take a class that has been particularly underprivileged, for example, and give them access to economic resource that no one else has, it creates a jealousy, and that jealousy can lead to a lot of racial feelings that maybe weren't there. Or bring them to the surface, perhaps. I mean, at the University of Florida, I'm aware that we've had tremendous faculty salary compression. And the faculty are leaving, faculty who are staying are doing it for because they love the town and they love their job, but the salaries are terrible. They bring in minorities and they give them far more money than the white faculty can make, and the white faculty are able to make. And it's so, to me, that's kind of like the same issue. But to not get sidetracked on gambling, I think when you give special economic favors and resources, I think that's part of what we see happening in Rwanda, is the result of one group of people getting special economic favors that led to years and years and years of hatred and hostility that finally blew up. That's my understanding of, and I think that racism has led to that. My understanding in South America, there's the blacks, the whites, and then the sort of in-betweens that were given more privileges by the whites, and now they think when the black have come into power that those more light-skinned blacks will suffer persecution from dark-skinned blacks. So I think it all has to do with economic favoritism given to certain people and the jealousies that it causes. So sometimes I think in trying to solve problems or whatever, more problems are created that can be very deeply rooted.
Mm-hmm. Well, this does raise, I mean, this is the affirmative action argument. And how do we redress economic issues that have certainly perpetuated or been driven by racism? You know, sort of what's the, and what you're posing is there, are we taking it to another extreme by offering economic favors based upon sort of race in another context? But that's a very interesting argument, because it does raise sort of all the fear questions about race and racism, which South Africa gave us a real big picture of. So I wanted to just sort of ask, in terms of the mirror, the picture that you gave, the vision. The struggle is sort of how to equalize a privilege, but the Native American people have certainly suffered historically from their land being taken away, and now they have. And I was in Minnesota and met a Native American gentleman who was very active in getting casino rights to Native Americans, and he was very interesting, because what he said was his argument was never the casino. His argument was the Indians having a right to determine for themselves whether or not what they would have on their reservations, and it sort of turned out to be sort of something that he did not necessarily intend for it to be. But this is, and it's an interesting, because in South Africa there are sort of the casinos in what used to be, I guess, the homelands. I guess they're not homelands anymore.
South Africa was always, the white government was, Afrikaners mainly at that time were very, they're deeply Calvinistic, and gambling, it just wasn't allowed. Gambling and sex were absolutely taboo. It had as much violence as you want. But, I mean, the movies, you could see the most violent movie you possibly could, but anything that had to do with sex or gambling was not allowed. So it was always, became something normal and couldn't be being independent. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's certainly an interesting question. In Chicago, we still don't have gambling. I mean, there's lots of opposition to the whole gambling question in terms of resources, but I'd never sort of thought of it in terms of a redistribution in lots of ways of the wealth, and how that becomes sort of a racial issue.
I could see that coming in Port Angeles area. Mm-hmm. There are three tribes that are probably for gambling, one starting at casino, right?
Minnesota's history, obviously, we started maybe about 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just moving into it in the state of Washington. Casinos are just under construction.
It'll be done in September, I think.
We open up on
in a couple of months, 2 months. The first one in Jamestown will be open in 2 months.
In 2 months already? Okay. So we're just kind of entering the phase of Minnesota.
But there are some hard feelings there. It's,
yeah.
I guess it also touches on my values. I don't personally like gambling. And I, but I understand the need to be able to. But I feel that the Indians should have the ability to go ahead. In fact, the Jamestown tribe sent a letter to all the organizations in the Port Angeles area asking for support for this as an economic development thing.
That's interesting, too. They said the Jamestown tribe is really being quite hotly criticized by other tribes for adopting Western ways and neglecting old traditional ways. adopting Western ways regarding making money, getting along with the whites in their practice and business.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Jamestown is one of the few places that has a white director. The director of Jamestown has historically, he has brought more funds into that community than any other community over the last 10 years. And they have the most developed enterprise of any of the tribes on the peninsula, I think, by far. He's white.
And the other issue that I just thought about, that which is to me very interesting, is I think America has not been able to solve our problem of our economy. It's getting worse. Mm-hmm. And here now is a new way, and I personally too am sort of against gambling. Here's a new economy that is put in place to solve economic problems in places predominantly where there is less. There are less resources, and here is the issue that is posed.
Well, on the positive side of the Minnesota Indians having, it's an opportunity to build wealth, and mm-hmm. money is power, and
absolutely.
Like some of the advertisements, the Indian people who run the gambling, they have advertisements of the charities that they're giving to, and there's nothing better for us to see than the image of that man making the decisions, or the Indian people that they're making the decisions where that money's going, and that it's good to see that balance of power shift, that they're not being given to, but they're giving back to other people.
Mm-hmm. I guess, sorry.
Yeah, but we don't want to get off on the gambling.
Well, I think it's really interesting because I think it speaks to the issues of the economics of racism.
Money is power.
This is the new issue for the 90s, I think, in lots of ways.
Well, but it's beyond racism in our community also. I mean, beyond gambling, the whole fishing issue also, fishing rights, tribal fishing rights, and our on the peninsula and in Washington generally, from the Bolts decision in the 70s. And of course, if you there's all kind of horror stories out there about other, you hear of Native Americans with Uzi machine guns wiping out an elk herd, and those kind of, and I think are total fabrications. But somehow those get built into the mix, and nobody bothers separating out what is or isn't, and it becomes that the Indians are the reason there's no salmon. There's no salmon fishing this year in the Strait of Juan de Fuca or on the coast, because the Indians have caught all the salmon. Well, but I think it's pretty much, don't you feel that's kind of a general understanding, that a lot of the trouble is because of tribal rights misused?
I think there are a group of people that do like to say that's the reason.
Oh no, I think it's totally false, but I think that there's,
You also hear a lot about, however, the building of dams,
yes,
pollution of the waters that have caused the decline in the populations, and that's not a racist issue, I don't think. I mean, although, of course, the Native Americans would certainly have just cause to complain about that, because the whites built the dams. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a point over here?
I'm just gonna add to this getting slightly illegal problem. In Canada, the cost of cigarettes is about 9/10 tax and 1/10 the actual. So there's extremely high tax on cigarettes and tobacco in general. Down along the St. Lawrence River, there's a place where the Mohawk Indians have a reservation on both sides of the border. And smuggling has become a very big business. So, but there again, they see a way of adding to their meager pittance that sometimes we allow them if they don't have an opportunity to work and choose to live on the reservation. Mm-hmm. So that creates a problem. Mm-hmm.
And in the inner cities, the issue is drugs. I mean, sort of the underground economy. Because, and again, I think this all speaks back to racism as an economic issue. And if we don't come to terms with the economy, I'm not sure how we'll tackle the problem of race, because it'll always be sort of based on who has and who doesn't have, and sort of the fear that goes along with having to give up resources. I mean, I don't want to have to give up the resources that I have. It's sort of scary to think about giving up what you have, but that's sort of what it sort of comes down to. Did you think?
Well, the other thought when you brought up drugs was just that it seems like when people are talking about, well, I don't necessarily support gambling or whatever, there's two sides of this. One is the economics it brings in. They're making millions of dollars or whatever she said. And that economics is power. But the downside of that is the cost that the people themselves pay, I think. And I know, and I don't mean to sound like I'm characterizing Indian, Native Americans in general as having this problem, but I know a woman who's Native American who lives on the reservation where there's gambling, and all her resources, that's where they've all gone. She never has enough, it's you know, like alcoholism, all the resources go there. That's the whole thing with the drug thing. It's like it's an economic boom, but it's a very unhealthy economic
Absolutely.
Boom. And so that while it brings tremendous economic wealth, there's also tremendous problems that it creates. You know, we all are familiar with the drug problems. And when we think about we want to take gambling from the Indian, from the Native Americans and make it to everybody, there's tremendous problems that go with that. And I think that's an unfortunate part of having, for example, on reservations, because it's more accessible to those who live close by and who may be economically disadvantaged to begin with, and now it's making a worse matter worse. So even though they may say, well, we're giving to all these great charities, what other problems is it creating along the way? So the part of the problem, like you said, is if people don't have access to mainstream economics and or any other more healthful type, or friendly and personal friendly economics, then the workplace gets to be a not very healthy place.
Mm-hmm. And it's sad that those economies are being built where people of color are. I mean, it's sad, and I mean, I do agree with you that there's, you know, wealth, and then and certainly in our country, money is everything. And that's real sad. I mean, it speaks to a real serious decay of sort of our moral character, which I think is really what sort of multiculturalism is all about, that if we don't embrace ourselves as human beings and all of our diversity, I personally feel that we just kind of continue down this road of decay, and we create sort of ways to sort of fix our problems, and those ways, you know, continue to sort of destroy us as a people. I mean, I live in Chicago where drugs are, you know, everywhere, and I see what it does. And it sort of camouflages the real problems, because the real problems are really not drugs. The real problems are people not having access to America, really. And this just sort of allows them to sort of live a life.
I know what you're saying, you're kind of skirting around an answer that I'm looking for.
I might not have it.
My question is, what is multiculturalism? Define the term, and what's the goal of it? What are we wanting?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a tremendous debate about it.
Peace.
Why don't we open that up? I think you asked a critical question, and that's one of the questions that I have here that we could talk about. So why don't we move into that?
Well, now, may I ask a question? Under that, would I don't know if I would say immigration. Now, we happen to live very near the Mexican border, and we have a great influx of Hispanics that come. In fact, in the city of just one crossing, in 1 month, 30,000 illegal aliens were taken back to return very shortly. You know, that's on everything. That's another thing that creates a problem. The people on one side think, well, no, why are all these people coming over taking our jobs? You know what I mean? And I don't know myself how I feel about it. I'm very close to it. And I like the Hispanics, but it's, I think in that case, we are encouraging them to come across the border illegally, but with our companies that are offering jobs or giving them jobs and enjoying the low wage rate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, and this may be getting away from the economic issues we've been discussing, but it seems to me that unless you're going to deal with class, I mean, it seems to me it's hard to do away with the issue of class, but when you deal with multiculturalism, to me, in a sort of more pure academic sense, that what you're looking at is really just being aware of other people's values and way of doing things. And I try to approach it almost like a clinical reasoning problem. Why did that person do that thing? What meaning does it have to them? And I think that just like any other kind of problem solving, your solutions and your ability to deal will depend partly on your knowledge. And I'll fill that broad stroke in a little bit. My son goes to a babysitter who's from India, and I made an assumption early on that she was Hindu because she's from India. And she asked us to send lunches. So I'm sending lunches, and one day I'm packing lunch and it's ham. And I'm thinking, I wonder if that's offensive to her to feed these children meat, you know. And I'm thinking, I wonder if ham is like more offensive than any other kind of meat. And so that day when I sent him, I asked her about that, and it turns out they're Muslim, and they have a taboo against pork in their home, and serving pork, and you're not going to send your ham. And I felt really bad about it. I mean, I felt like, I said, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to be offensive, you know. And she hadn't said anything. And she said she had probably said something the day we were looking into sending him there, but I don't recall that she said anything that she did it. Maybe it was just that I had so many other things on my mind, and at that point in time he was only eating baby food, so it was like, didn't register, because that wouldn't have been something I would have sent. So I think, and in other situations too, to ask the question, why is there a communication problem? Why is this person reacting a certain way to something? Is there some other experience that they've had, or some religious or cultural meaning to this activity that I don't understand? Mm-hmm. And I think that when you just go for that understanding, that can help clear up a lot of things. But it has to dawn on you that this isn't just this person isn't trying to be difficult. You know, because people have always just tried to be difficult sometimes, you know, and to sort of separate out, well, when is a person just trying to be difficult and you're just not going to get along with them, and when is there something else going on? And what are the questions to ask?
Mm-hmm. Let me just throw out, just for some thinking, what I have begun to think about in terms of multiculturalism. First of all, America has been multicultural ever since, I don't know how far back, before Columbus got here, I suspect. So the reality exists and has existed for hundreds of years that America is a multicultural country. We have not embraced as a country, I don't think, what that means in its fullest sense. And I think racism is an example of that, where we have not embraced it, where we've had, you know, people from all over the world coming to America for various reasons. So we've always been a multicultural country, dominated by Western European values and ways of being and lifestyles. And I don't know, I mean, you might disagree with that, and there may be some disagreement with that in certain ways, but for the most part, how we live our lives is pretty much based upon sort of a Western point of view, even though we have people from all over the world in America and always have had. Some people, and you know, they're in the 50s and the 60s, the whole idea of the melting pot, and that America was is a melting pot, has existed for a certain group of people and not existed for other groups of people. And so to say that you have access to America for African Americans has not totally been true, because particularly African Americans have not had access to Americans, and they have not even had access to be able to embrace Western values, because we've not been allowed to live and to work and to be in those places in the world generally. So there's been some disparity. But I think the question to me that's posed right now is, and I'm a multiculturalist, and I think of myself as a multiculturalist, in that I think that we have to embrace the world, and we have to embrace values from all over the world in America. That to me is what sort of signifies what America is in the vision, in the dream. But the question that kind of gets posed that I'm troubled by is that, I'm an American, and I love being an American. Central American, I'd love that. Or if I was a South African, I'd love that. I'd want to love wherever I am, and I would want to understand sort of the faults of that place. But I wouldn't want to be in a place that I didn't love. So I do love being an American, and I love being American. But there are some overarching values, I think, that hold us together as a nation. And what does multiculturalism do to those overarching values that hold us together as a nation? Because we certainly want to be a strong nation. I don't think there's a doubt about that. We don't want to be a weak nation that can get invaded by whoever wants to invade us, because we're weak-willed and weak-valued and weak-minded, which I think we are. I think we're growing in our weakness. I don't know that I think we're growing in our strength. I personally think we're growing in our weakness. And I think that's because we haven't embraced ourselves as a country. We kind of let the racism keep gnawing at us and gnawing at us. But I also have this other question, and that is, what are those common overarching values that we have that are American, that are not anything and everything, but they are, we all can agree on them and we can all support them? And I'm not sure that we've come to know what they are, and we come to know how to embrace them, and that this particular time in our life we're struggling with what those values are. And they range from lifestyles to sexual preferences to, I mean, I think that there's a lot that we struggle with in this country, and then I think it troubles people to think that these are values that maybe are very different. I too have an experience in my workplace. I work in a predominantly Latino organization, and you know, I'm married to a Puerto Rican, and I figure I know all about what it means to be Latino. I live with one. And I was struck by, I have a woman who is a clinical director that I supervise, and she's the kind of person that we would talk about projects, and she'd go off and do the project, and I'd never hear from her again. And it would just aggravate the hell out of me. Because I think, why didn't she come back to me and tell me what she's done? You know, I expect to hear back from her what she's done. And we were in a discussion talking about diversity, and she said to me that in a Latino family, that it's rude for a child, if a mother gives a child an assignment and says, go do your homework, it's very rude for that child to come back to mother and say, I've done my assignment, here it is. That it's an affront. I mean, it's sort of an insult, because you have this respect for your adults, and you have respect, and that you're not that forward. And I thought about that, and I said, that's probably why, when she has an assignment to do, I never hear from her again until I go to her and ask her, where is the assignment? And I thought, okay, that's aggravating to me. I don't like that. I want her to come back to me and tell me when she's finished with an assignment. It takes too much energy out of me to have to remember what it was I asked her to do, to go find her and tell her to come back. And I really thought about this in the context of values. And I said, I am her boss, and I have a lot of power in this situation. And I can tell her how I want her to respond to me. I can dictate what values I want to have happen in this workplace. And I thought about that a whole lot in the context of culture and in the context of racism. That it's not enough just to know that we have some values that are different. It isn't enough to say, you know, I value one thing and you value one thing. Okay, it's great. But I think in our culture, we have this thing that's called racism, which is all about power. I can tell you that I don't like that value. And if you want to coexist with me here, you better change that value, because I have the power to tell you to do that. And it made me think a whole lot about how difficult it is to accept values, different values and different ways of being. It's very difficult, because we are who we are, and we just don't want to change who we are. We think we do. And something as little as that, my husband has this thing that he always says to me, you don't want to go to a movie tonight, do you? And I think, well, if you don't want me to go to the movie, why are you asking me? But it's just his way of speaking, because Latinos kind of speak in the negative. And I know that, but I don't want him to approach me like that. I want him to say, would you like to go to the movies? And if I have control of the situation, which I don't, because he doesn't ask me anymore, do I want to go? then I can dictate what the values are. And so I think it's important to understand that. It's not enough just to understand the differences, but it's really important to figure out, how do we want to really incorporate the differences? And then when we do that, what do we really want the overarching values to be? And I think that's the struggle. Because I think we can live day to day with each other. And I think we can sort of deal with the little nuances of our differences. But who's going to decide what are the values that our whole country is based on, and how do we buy into that? That to me is the real struggle. It's not the day-to-day, am I going to eat Thai food today or you know, mashed potatoes and corn. I mean, that to me is not the fundamental struggle. The fundamental struggle is what's going to define who we are as America.
I got a question. Do you think that racism is degressing or regressing in the United States? No.
I think racism just takes on a different face in a different period. And no, I don't think that it. I don't think racism is going away.
Oh no, it isn't. But it's regressing. That's what I think.
I think that there are. I personally feel that racism, the face of racism, is becoming a bigger economic face. And it's growing in places like Chicago inner city, and it's growing in, you see it in the inner cities. I think that's the face of racism.
Well, that's I used to travel around there because I like the music. And I've gone to house rent parties. Have you ever heard
house
of those?
Rent? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
But here, not that young.
My wife and I, we traveled around. So, you know, well, like 47th and South Park. Mm-hmm. There's a Savoy Ballroom there. Well, any other.
But that's not there anymore, but.
So
that's not there anymore. But.
No, I guess not. But anyway, we enjoyed ourselves there. Never had a problem with the people we knew. And never had the feeling that, I don't know, black, colored, or Afro-American? What's the preference? But anyway, we enjoyed ourselves there. Today, I would be a little hesitant about doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's everything's gone to pot. And I assume it's partially our fault. Partially, a lot of it's our fault, feeling that way. Mm-hmm. But I feel as though that the racism is regressing, or I should say, the whites getting along with the blacks and vice versa. And how the heck can you stop it unless you know the people?
I would like to think that there's a critical mass of like-minded people growing in America that will not tolerate racism. But I also think that growing critical mass of people who will not tolerate racism don't know what to do about it. And part of the reason why we don't know what to do about it is because we're very disconnected in our lives and we're growingly disconnected from institutions that we had a lot of trust and faith in that sort of helped us to direct, you know, our personal energies against ills that we saw in society. So we're sort of a bunch of individuals that are sort of out here sitting with feelings of injustice that we don't have any place to do anything with them. So I think in some ways, I think racism is growing, but I think it's growing in proportion to our inability to deal with it. And our inability to deal with it is based upon our being totally disconnected from any institutional life. I mean, you know, we are here in a retreat center that is predominantly a religious retreat center. But you go back out into the world in your life and think about the places where you're connected, and we're less and less connected from places that would help us as a group collective direct our energies against ills in our society.
Especially, I mean, there's no community.
Especially our churches, exactly.
Well, there's no community. There used to be community. A church was in a community, and there was a sense of community, and now the numbers of people are so big, you have to get in your car and drive over here to be at this church, or to go to work, or to do this, or to do that, and you're in your car driving around all the time, and I think that's part of what disconnects you, because there is no sense of, often even in neighborhoods, you know, I'm visiting in the Marshfield, Wisconsin, a town of 19,000, and staying with my nephew, and he was saying something about the neighbors. He goes, well, we don't know them. They're living in a duplex.
What I was saying yesterday is a friend of mine just said she thought one of the major problems in America is that we've gone from the front yard to the backyard.
Yeah.
You know, and now we're in the backyard and we have big fences and we don't know who lives across those fences because we're not communing with our neighbors anymore.
But on the other hand, don't you think money is it? Then it comes down to money, which has created the majority of those things that has taken away the community life. It definitely has taken away that. It's also taken away the church life, mm-hmm. the community life and the church. And it's broken up the families. And it all boils down to money, even when it comes to racism.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, that's true. When you talk about money, you think about, I don't know if you're thinking about this, but I think about sharing. Now we all have our own pools. We don't have to go to the community pool. Mm-hmm. You know,
I don't. Where do you live? I don't live. My dream of life is to have a swimming pool.
I live in Florida, and a lot of people have their own pools. And when I lived in central Wisconsin, people didn't have their own pools. See, the swimming season wasn't that long, so we all, you know, that's a fond memory of my childhood, was going to the public pool. And you go with all your friends and going to the public ice rinks and skating. And you know, you have these community things that you just shared, you know, that you walked to and that you did and was part of your neighborhood. But it seems like now we all have to have our own everything. You know, we even have to have our own televisions in our own rooms. And so
I was at a workshop and they asked, how many people have one television? A few people hand. How many people have two televisions? More people hand. How many people have three televisions? Four people's hands went up. They got all the way up to seven televisions. How many people have seven televisions? And there were a few that had seven. But it's right, we're so disconnected from each other. But it's our wealth that we don't do well with.
It's a me society now. It's a giving, you know, this is what I want, I earn it, you stay away, you know.
It goes to the overarching value of individualism. Right. This country was founded on not only just individualism, but rugged individualism. Rugged individualism says that you pull yourself up by the bootstraps mm-hmm. and you make it on your own and you don't need help mm-hmm. if you're a good character, which of course is a myth. But so I think that's part of it, and also the respect of authority. But I have to say I disagree with you a little bit about the problem being totally the overarching values, because I do think, just like in a marriage, those little day-to-day things do gnaw at you. You know, it's the squeezing of the toothpaste from the bottom and the which way you put the toilet paper on the holder that are those little things mm-hmm. that, you know, and I think that happens in race relations too. That it's the little things that I don't understand. Why don't you invite me into your house? Because, well, in India, people don't have people into their homes, so what's the deal here, you know?
Well,
the solution, I think, is partly A, being aware, and then B, being assertive. For example, I think the example you gave with the person you work with is if you would simply say to them in an assertive way, you know, as your supervisor, I would prefer it if you did this. Would that be difficult for you? Wouldn't it be to disregard her values? I don't think.
Because I think to disregard her values would be to say that they're stupid and that's not a good way. Maybe that's okay at home, but it's not okay at work, and to say that's bad. But rather to, since you have values too, you get to have values, not just values.
But I think it is a struggle between to sort of how to coexist. I work in a hierarchy, and I hate it because I'm forced to think a certain way that's against what I'd like for my nature to be. I'm not sure that I really think it is, but I think it's not. And I think that that's what creates, in that situation, an inability to come to terms with that person has a different way of working than I do, because I'm forced to sort of respond to that person there. And I do agree with you. I think if we all sort of thought about where are the places in our lives where people who are different from us intersect with us, and I think we'd be real sad to realize that it's probably in the public domain. There are probably very, very few private places where we have interactions with people who are different from us. And you know, there are some places where we do have those interactions. But it's very, and I think where America has come, where we have gotten better, is that we have public places where we interact with each other. But we don't have those private places, and it's sort of like sharing food and sharing those places. And if we don't figure out how to do that, and I think we're growing further and further apart. I mean, people who live outside the city may come to the city to take advantage of sort of a more multicultural experience, but it's not in relationship to people's lives as much as it is in relationship to sort of those institutions that represent people's lives. And then we kind of go back to wherever we are. I mean, I live in a community that's Black and Latino, and that's where my life is. Black and Latino. There is not a lot of them. I come to Holden and get a different experience. And it saddens me because I'd like to see more people like me here.
But then we all go back.
But I think it's important, and I think you raise a very important question, and that is, what does it mean to be multicultural? In the year 2000, what does that really mean for this country? And what does that mean if we are struggling to survive as a country, and we are struggling to come to terms with not just a buffet of values? I think it's great to have a buffet of values, but it's important to have some really deeply ingrained values that we all can ascribe to make us a strong people here. And I think, you know, as much as I push for multiculturalism, I certainly don't support nationalism and tribalism and all of those things that separate us as people. I mean, I've gone through that. I've gone through my Black Power stage in my life. And I certainly have gathered a lot of self-esteem about who I am as an African-American person in this country. However, I know that there are some extremes, and we see that happening all over the world. I mean, we see all over the world where people are separating themselves because of their own unique differences. And I don't think that that's what we want to create. I don't think that we want to honor each other so much that we say, okay, you go over there and live in your little world and have your world separate to yourself. That, you know, here are reservations where you can create your own community, and it can be totally separated from the rest of America. Because what will that produce? I mean, I think that produces what we currently have, which is isolation and hostilities and fear. And so I think that when we look at the question of multiculturalism, it's important to figure out where is the line drawn, and who draws it? You know.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because I was listening to some African Americans. I'm not used to using that phrase because I'm not. Don't have to use it.
It's all right. My dad's from the colored stage. He still uses the terminology colored. You know, we've long gone past that.
But he's
African American, so. You know.
I was listening to some young people talking about how they want their own language. There's a slang that goes, and I couldn't even begin to imitate it, but you know what I'm saying. And they want Black people to talk that way because that's our culture, that's our heritage, and so what if we can't understand half of what they're talking about? And I thought, now that, you know, that's kind of like when we were in the school, we used to talk Pig Latin. We thought we were carrying on this private conversation with someone by speaking Pig Latin. And that's kind of what I was thinking when I heard these kids talking, that that maybe they don't want us to understand, or I did, it threw me. I thought, what's the point of encouraging them to talk that way if most of us can't understand it?
That's pride.
Well, and that's probably fun for them if they, you know, the street slang or whatever. But then to take a step further, there's the, well, you probably see it coming up from Florida, the Haitians coming in. A lot of those are into animal sacrifices, their religion. And they're starting to have their animal sacrifices in America. Well, that's illegal to do that. But that's their culture. And like you say, where do you draw the line? And there was just a Supreme Court ruling just recently, these Native Americans that wanted to smoke their peyote in their religious practice, that they were arrested and went through all these trials, put in jail for smoking peyote because that's against the law. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, well, religion prevails, they can have their peyote. So it's okay for them to have their peyote, but no one else can have their marijuana or whatever, not that we want them to, but...
Mm-hmm. You know, where, make religion about it.
Yeah, where do you draw the line and say, we don't do that here. Mm-hmm. If you're gonna live in America, you're gonna speak so we understand you, and you understand us. And
well, even the language. I mean, the Americans, the English language.
Danger is because the white society has been dominant society. So there's the danger of saying, sure, come on in, but you've got to assimilate. You've got to like us. And you know, you mentioned earlier the whole melting pot stage that America, oh yeah, come on in, let's be a melting pot. But that requires assimilation. A melting pot is like stew, where everything kind of tastes the same. And I think what we need to think about, as in, like you said, the year, I think it's the year 2010 or 20, that there will be no majority in America. That it's going to be completely multicultural. And I think that we need to start thinking of ourselves more as a term I heard once, as a salad bowl, where you're all in there together, but each bite has its own unique flavor and, you know, texture and et cetera, et cetera, so that each culture can coexist in one place and yet keep their culture and not be forced to, you know, assimilate. And it's hard because, I mean, I think... The white society just needs to give up some of that dominance and power.
How are we
going to make laws then that, like I know the Indians having their gambling on their reservations, and that's okay, they don't have to pay any taxes on any of that. Mm-hmm. The Indians can catch as many salmon as they want, whereas we're limited to two.
Haitians can kill animals, but we can't.
Right. I think what I'm saying is that our government is dominated by the white society, so we need to bring everybody else into those decision-making positions.
I don't think we have a lot of public debate about these things. I mean, I think the problem is that we have laws that says you can't do that. And that's okay. I mean, I'm not opposed to having laws that say you can't do certain things. But I have a family that lives right behind me. And about a month ago, they found, you know, a house full of goats and dogs and sheep and chickens where they were having animal sacrifice. And I sort of, as a spectator, drove past there to kind of see what it looked like. You know, oh, I want to see these spooky looking people living behind me. And I thought, I don't even know what animal sacrifice is all about. I don't even know what that religion is all about. And there was debate on TV, on the news, as much debate as you can get on the news, about, you know, that it is legal to practice that religion. It is not illegal to practice that religion. And I thought, okay, I don't even understand it. How dare I assume that there's something wrong with it? And my values tell me that there's something wrong with it. But I don't know it. I don't even understand it. So there's a certain responsibility that I have to understand it before, I think, I use the power that I have, which are my values, to say that it's not okay and to legislate to say that it's not okay because I don't even understand it. It almost seems as if we have a responsibility first to try to understand something. Then I think we have a right to have an opinion about it and a dialogue about it. But I think our first responsibility, and I don't know that I think we have done that very well, that we've imposed a certain value system without really even understanding sort of another point of view. And that's, I think, probably, and we don't have places where there's public discussion about that point of view and that point of view so that we understand it before we decide. And to me, multiculturalism really speaks to, are we allowing people the right to say what their values are and what they mean before we decide that they're not okay to have? So I think that's, you know, and we may decide that it's not okay, but before we really know what it is, how can we decide that it's not okay?
You know, the whole thing of animal sacrifice, I think, is kind of fascinating because, you know, you can't read the Old Testament very long before you get into that. And with that, of course, as a culture, as Lutherans, we would accept what happened in the temple as God, you know, sacrificing animals to God. And we understand animal sacrifice. You know, thousands of animals were slaughtered in the temple. But we can somehow get a picture of that, you know, the Chicago stockyards. You know, how would you differentiate what was happening there between that and animal sacrifice? I mean, but see, we accept kinds of animal sacrifice, but because we understand that that's what hamburger is. When we go to McDonald's, that's what we get. So,
and there's not a lot of it here at Holden.
Yeah. Well, I do have some steak that's $35 a pound, but I'll tell you.
My daughters have no problem with that.
So, you know, I think that's the point you're making is that, you know, I think understanding is important because somehow we focus on the activity without approaching what that activity is about.
Mm-hmm. This woman over here, you just sort of...
Yeah, well, I was reacting to, walking back to, you know, sort of the salad bowl and what are we choosing, and I think it's a not only but also is the solution. That we not only have our own sense of our individual values, because that's important to our cultural heritage and our identity, and that's important to have. And if that means subgrouping, like the Lutherans and the this and the that, that's okay. But I think there has to be an also, which we haven't spent very much time to develop, and that is something that makes us all hang together. Maybe we talk about overarching values or an understanding of the way each other operates and what these things mean. So I think that while I think it would be sad if we lost the individual sense, yet I think when I go to Germany, I don't expect that everybody there would have to speak English. Now, I try to learn as much language as I can, and I attach myself to someone who speaks the language because I don't expect it. I was very surprised when I went there how many people spoke English. I certainly didn't expect it. You know, I certainly didn't command it. And I think that some communication somehow has to be open. I think that when you can't communicate, then you can't even understand. So that's a real problem. And I think people have different styles of communication too. Like you were talking about your husband. You know, so like you have to be really a good communicator. And how many of us are really good communicators? We just get angry when something doesn't go our way and we feel like that person is going to be difficult rather than trying to understand them. So I think a lot of it goes back to just good, strong interpersonal skills of feeling comfortable with who you are, being a good communicator, and being assertive. Because it's okay to have your own values. And I think for white people, at the risk of sounding racist, sometimes we get the message that our own values aren't okay. It's not okay to impose them on everybody else, but it's okay to have them.
And I think the challenge for white people is to figure out what your values are. And I say that not as a nasty commentary, but I think that it's so normal to say white values, when in fact you represent lots of different backgrounds, and it's important to figure out where those are and embrace them, because white in this country means something not too positive, but who you are in terms of. We had this discussion yesterday about American and having sort of other kinds of sort of heritages are important to embrace and to see yourselves in sort of a fuller sense rather than to sort of in this narrow sense of being white. So let's just end there. Thank you for coming. We're done. I think they turned it off already. It's tomorrow at 10:30, I think. I'm
well, that's fine. In the morning sometimes.
10:30. Well, today I thought I was going to be showing the video, but I didn't today, so I'm going to show it tomorrow.
What video is that?
It's either going to be, I haven't decided yet. This place sort of makes you rethink every minute of what you're doing. It's either going to be ethnic notions, which is about stereotypes, or it's going to be the brown eye, blue eye experiments, which is about kids who, in 1965, Jane Elliott did some experiment with kids on differences, and very starking the way in which kids learn to differentiate quickly, very quickly, and sort of speaks to how we're sort of internalize our attitudes. So I might do that one tomorrow. I like that one better than the other one, but I haven't decided yet.
You know, if you could just come down with an edict, thus says. How would you change
the world according to Mary's category?
How would you change it to be multicultural? I'm speaking as a white woman. What would you change?
I would certainly, I mean, very simply, I would certainly encourage that our children learn more about each other in a much more expansive way. I mean, you know, my kid is 12 years old. She has learned nothing in school about being African American. They don't teach it to her. She lives in the city of Chicago. Now she goes to the Missouri Senate Lutheran School.
I was going to ask where.
But so she doesn't learn anything about herself, and I don't think that there is a lot of sort of teaching kids about in our educational system.
That's one thing I really valued for our family, our children, our four children, that we were living in a culturally diverse part of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And they have friends who are blacks, who are Jewish, who are Japanese, who are Chinese, and they interacted when they were in elementary and senior high school.
I have a very close Jewish friend, and it pains me that we cannot talk about religion. It's painful to me that we cannot talk about religion, because the minute we start talking about religion, the deepest part of our cores to come out. So there's no legitimacy to learning about each other in the deepest way. So I would probably force us to embrace some learning that's a much more expansive learning.
That reminds me of the invitation we got from Judy Dolbury's family, one of my oldest daughter's best friend, of our family to come and celebrate with them some of the celebrations in their home.
Mm-hmm.
So that was in the mid 50s to mid 60s, I lived there, and we are more separate now,
mm-hmm.
of course.
But part of the problem is that there's so much diversity in Oakland, for instance, they speak 78 languages
mm-hmm.
in one school district.
Sure. Wow.
And they keep making noise about wanting more bilingual teachers. Well,
mm-hmm.
there aren't that many teachers out there that can handle all those different languages.
Yeah.
So you really, and how could you possibly teach each of those cultures to affirm each kid? But really, it just seems like a mind-boggling problem. And I think, and that's maybe not typical of every community, but
yeah.
It's more and more so. And if, when we get to 2010, how do we get to know those people, except one-on-one?
Yeah.
When you're talking
it's
about.
Impossible,
yeah.
really.
But the heritage should be taught at home.
Your class teach. And mark is important.
Well, I think in some, I mean, certainly the African-American experience, unlike other ethnic experiences, I will say, if you don't know what your heritage is, then how can you teach it? And I think in the African-American community, for decades and for centuries, you didn't even know what you're, you didn't, you, it wasn't legitimized
mm-hmm.
to know anything. There wasn't anything to know. You didn't come from anything other than sort of backward slave sort of mentality people. So you can't, and I think that experience is a little different than some other sort of third world or other immigrant experiences that if you don't know it and honor it, then how can you teach it? And so I think that that's,
I mean, that's the travesty, that you don't know it. You don't have any. You don't have anything that tells you about it. You know, there aren't books. I mean, certainly now there are, but there aren't symbols of you around to embrace. And so how can you teach it if you don't honor it yourself? And I think the sadness about the African-American community now, probably different than maybe 50 years ago, is that the African-American community, I mean, we've internalized negative images of ourselves so deeply that I think you were in the workshop that I did for Lutheran, weren't you there? I mean, the African-American people in that group had more hatred towards themselves than any of the white folks in that group had towards them, or at least what was projected. And so if you could carry around an image of yourself that is very extremely negative, then how do you teach what's a glorious past or history if that's not what you embrace for yourself? And that's what we've done, is we've not honored. You know, someone asked me, you know, are there positive African-American role models in the African-American community, because all kids sort of see, at least in the city, are images of drug dealers and images of, you know, sports stars and those kinds of images. Well, you know, I mean, we don't have control over the media, so who gets projected? I mean, we have in Chicago the first African-American man to sail around the world. He lives in Chicago. Who sees that? Nobody sees that. We don't project it. You know, so we don't get a chance to sort of say, here, somebody, he lives right here in your back door. So I don't know. I mean, I think you pose a real interesting dilemma. I wish I had thought about it.
I think the challenge for white people is to become sensitive, like she was saying with her babysitter, to understand how we might offend somebody, but then not pussyfoot around. You know, just ask what's offensive, maybe, and then don't do it, or to realize, you know, that. And we had Cambodian children, and the pastor went to a class, so he knew that you don't put your head. He didn't put his hand on the top of their head when he blessed them at communion, mm-hmm. because that's a total no-no. Mm-hmm. So he learned that, and he put it on their shoulder. Otherwise, it would have been. I mean, they would never have come back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a simple thing, but unless you ask, how are you going to know that?
Right. But you have to be exposed, because if you're not exposed and you think, you know, I mean, certainly there are cultures in Chicago that I'm not exposed to, and I'm real, you know, tentative about even asking, because we're so isolated from each other, and we don't create spaces where publicly we can, other than schools, where publicly, and it seems like to me in schools they ought to be teaching each other how to embrace. My daughter had an experience a couple years ago where she and this other little girl got into this fight, and so I suggested to the teacher, and it was around race, and so I suggested to the teacher, well, then what, this is a teachable moment for teachers. This is a teachable moment. This isn't a discipline moment. This is a teachable moment. Let's teach these little girls about, you know, my daughter is mixed, and this other little girl is African-American. She was calling her white and, you know, all kinds of stuff, and I said, then why don't you teach these kids something? Well, you know, the teacher fumbled around, didn't do a very good job of it, and sent the kids home with an assignment to learn about their heritage, which was fine if she had had them come back to the classroom and have a discussion about it, but she didn't. She just said, go home and learn about your heritage, which was, you know, only half of it. And my daughter came home, and my daughter said, she's, you know, half me and half of her dad, and I'm half of lots of things, and he's Puerto Rican, so she's mixed with lots of things. And she asked me, what was her heritage? And she was so little, she must have been in third grade, I think. And she asked me, so I started giving her this long speech about, well, your dad's from Puerto Rico, and in Puerto Rico they do this, and they do like this, and they live like this. And your mom, you know, she's had this, and she's had this. She just had this aggravated look on her face, and finally she said to me, I don't really want to know what you are. I want to know what I am. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like, you know, we don't, you know, we teach people about people in the abstract, you know, and we don't create opportunities for them to sort of subjectify that. I don't know if that's the right term, but to learn about it in a real subjective way. So we may teach about it in school, but then those kids don't have those experiences. They're not with each other. They don't. In Chicago, we have this wonderful program, which is called Urban Studies, and the
the folks who are here, that come here to hold dinner. Founders of that program were kids in a lot of Midwestern colleges, a lot of the Lutheran colleges, St. Olaf and in Minnesota, a lot of those colleges in Minnesota, send kids to Chicago for 3 months, and they sort of live there in the city for 3 months, and they work in different kinds of organizations and agencies, and they're exposed to the city. And a lot of those kids end up staying there. I mean, and it's not, and the attraction is not just the city. The attraction has a lot to do with their experiences, are very enriching experiences, because they get to put some of the theory that they learned back in their home communities into sort of practice. And they're very much more enriched as individuals because they really get to live the experience. So
I think it does take boldness. It takes, you know, being willing to go to a city for 3 months, or, you know, being willing to put yourself...
It takes your parents being bold to send them off to the city for 3 months.
You know, but it does. I mean, I think for all of us, it does take boldness. It's hard and it's fearful and you're not sure what you're going to get into. But if you really care about it, you're going to do it.
Even one-on-one, I think it takes boldness
it
to
does.
Ask
yeah.
if we don't understand, just to ask somebody. Most people aren't offended if you very honestly say, well, I don't really understand why you do it that way. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, what does this mean to you?
Yeah.
So the agency of Winston work in and talk about CP time. There's nothing as far as on time, it's on colored people time.
But in the Puerto Rican community, it's PR time, yeah. And it's worse than CP time. So I don't feel so bad. I sort of feel mainstream.
Yeah, right. But that was one of those little things. I'd be like, you know, if you're around this meeting, where is everybody? Kind of aggravates you. And then they sort of meander in. Oh, I was doing this. Or ran into so-and-so. And I'm saying, come on down, business, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a learning process.
Yeah.
We had a and what was Wamba? Wanga?
Pardon me?
What was Wanga? Zulu. That's from Wanga, who visited our church.
Oh.
Yeah, he was Zulu, and of course everybody had places for him to go, a few things for him to do, but
he sort of laid back.
Wanga was going. That's what Wanga does. He liked to watch TV at 3 o'clock at night, but everybody was really getting irritated towards the end that they just couldn't get him to go where they wanted him to go when they wanted him to go. I think they finally gave up, but he persevered.
Yeah, there's lots of little, you know, lots of, you're right, I mean, you do have to ask. You have to not be afraid to step over the line and offend, or at least be embarrassed in your own questioning.
Yes.
You know, not feel so, and feel vulnerable. Just
we've been
be
in a position where we've been one-on-one and very tiptoed because we didn't want to offend. And from the a very dear friend now, a black woman, assistant pastor, she just comes right out and says what she wants to say and doesn't worry about being offensive, and it's wonderful.
Yeah.
But we've been so kind of clued in that, well, you don't want to make waves, or you don't want to look like a racist, and so you're careful, and then you're almost, it's almost racism because you're so careful.
Yeah.
Instead of just being honest.
My Jewish friend and I don't think we would have been as close friends if we had not struggled together around the questions of race and our differences around that, and we're willing to struggle, and we're willing to accept being in pain because of that struggle. And I you know, I always find that a lot of folks that I would like to have relationships with, when we're not able to struggle together around those questions of race, and we don't get beyond the relationship, we just kind of get to a point and then we say, I don't want to be around her anymore because, you know, these things are going to come up and we're not going to be able to struggle around it. But it is very difficult, and that's why I think we haven't created the places. And, you know, I would say that probably as an African American, we have been guilty of, and I'm not sure that I would say guilty to a negative fault, but we have certainly been guilty of creating, you know, the intimidation, so that now it's very difficult for us to have open debates, because white people are scared to death to have honest, get down, drag out fights with African Americans, because they don't want to be called racist and they don't want to sort of have all that drugs up. So we don't have the opportunity to sort of just get it out there and get beyond it. And I think that's really very sad. I mean, I think that's really sad that we've gotten to a place where we can't have public discussion and debate around issues of our own differences. Because I don't think if we don't create those places, I don't think we're going to go very far. I think we're going to get stuck there.